Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 27th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. Now let's get started with some local news from Fort Dodge. Our first headline today reads, Classic Christmas. Williamson returns to give concert at St. Paul. Hearing Jenny Williamson sing has become an annual Christmas tradition for many area families, and it's a tradition they will be able to continue this year. Williamson, a Christian singer with a local connection, will perform her annual concert beginning at 6:30 p.m. Saturday at St. Paul Lutheran Church, located at 400 South 13th Street. It will be her 19th show in Fort Dodge. This is for the community, anybody and everybody, she said in a phone interview. It's open to all. She said whenever she sings in Fort Dodge, she sees familiar faces in the audience, but she also sees new families every year. My favorite thing to do is to bring back a great memory for people, but also create some new memories, Williamson said. Her concert will feature a lot of classic Christmas songs and hymns, plus a few that may be new to the audience. On some songs, she will be accompanied by students from St. Paul Lutheran School. I think we can bring a whole lot of atmosphere of peace, she said. Although she is not from the area, her husband, Brian Williamson, is. He grew up in Fort Dodge and attended St. Paul Lutheran Church. The tradition of her annual concerts in the city emerged from that connection. We don't even think twice about it, he said. It's a tradition for us. For many years, they lived in Franklin, Tennessee, near Nashville. Recently, they moved to Perry County, Missouri, and became ambassadors for the Saxon Lutheran Memorial there. Brian Williamson said immigrants from Saxony in Germany moved there to escape persecution at home. He described the area as the birthplace of the Lutheran Church in America. The Saxon Lutheran Memorial is a collection of cabins and other structures dating from the 1830s when the immigrants from Saxony arrived in the area. It is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. We are working to create a place of restoration and retreat, Brian Williamson said of their role at the memorial. Their move and new role will be reflected in some of the selections for the upcoming concert. We will tie them together, Jenny Williamson said. Our next headline reads, Stepping Up in a Historic Time. David Stuckenberg joins GOP race for president. The dateline is Webster City. David Stuckenberg dropped by the Daily Freeman Journal last week, shortly after the national news media began buzzing about the latest Republican to seek his party's nomination for the office of President of the United States. Stuckenberg, a decorated and highly educated military consultant, said he felt an urgency to run after a conversation with his son on September 11th. I asked my son, who is 18 years old, and 9/11 was before his time, if he knew the story, he said. Over yard work, Stuckenberg told of a man named John O'Neill, who knew that the World Trade Centers would be attacked a second time, the first being the unsuccessful attack in 1993. O'Neill asked the government for the resources to stop a second attack. It was refused. So Stuckenberg told his son, instead of simply retiring, O'Neill got a job at the top of one of the towers. He climbed to the top of the World Trade Center, and he stood for what was right, and for what was just, and what was true. And he stood as a sentry, and he died in the 9/11 attacks. So the question I asked my son Timothy while we were in the yard, what do you think he would say if he could come back and talk? And my son inspired me with his answer. I think he would say, never give up on the United States of America, no matter how small the chance of a turnaround. Stuckenberg said, we have to do three things immediately, and these are the three points of my campaign. We have to immediately cut taxes that are choking and strangling the economy around the United States. Every man, woman, and child's buying power is being reduced to ashes. Furthermore, I'm going to eliminate the inheritance tax because it's immoral to save your whole life and to pass on an inheritance to your heirs and have the government take more than half of it. To halt unchecked immigration, he wants to use the military under Title 32 to close our borders to stop the influx. Provide illegals already here a 60-day period to register, undergo a health screening, and a background check. They may register with NGO and victim advocates or any post office. These steps will add an estimated 8 to 10 million people to the U.S. tax base, set people free from trafficking and slavery, and rise to a better version of ourselves to care for and help those in need, his website says. With an even greater urgency, Stuckenberg talked about the U.S.'s standing when it comes to national security, particularly with its relationship with China. We have not had a war game that we have been successful in defeating China since 2008, and yet we continue to do the same thing and get the same result. We can turn that script around. We can flip that script. We know how to beat them. But even now, on one more strategy that happened to come out this year that I had my hands on and that I have shaped, my hands have shaped. I'm the guy who shared in 2015, balloons will be used to access the United States. And here's how, and no one listened. And then it happened. Early in the interview, Stuckenberg said, I am not a politician. I'm considered one of America's premier national security strategists. I am the deputy director of strategy at the Texas National Guard, which is our foremost reserve component in the country. I'm here on my own as a citizen because I believe our republic is fading very fast. I believe we're approaching a tipping point described by Edward Gibbon, who is an author who wrote in the 1700s about the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire, he said. And so the economy, stopping illegal immigration, and finally having a national security enterprise that is second to none in the world, he said, reiterating his three priorities. Major Stuckenberg is acting director of strategic plans at Texas Air National Guard, Camp Mabry, Austin, Texas. He co-founded Genesis Systems, a global green tech company solving global water scarcity with renewables. He holds a doctorate in international security from King's College, a master in politics from George Washington University, and a Bachelor of Science in Technology from University of Central Missouri. He is also a husband and a father of five children. So we are living in a historic time, a time of choosing, and we have all the capability and a sound constitution that is an inspired document of goodness. And there is nothing wrong with it. And our politicians continue to try to build roads through it, around it, and tunnel under it. It needs to be respected. It was inspired and brought together by people who understood that human nature progresses towards tyranny when you center power in one man. The temptation is too great for most humans, he said. As he was leaving, he said his favorite president was the first, General George Washington, because he declined to take on an unwholesome level of power. He does not see former President Donald Trump as a good way forward. Remember, and I hope it will make it into your article, but remember how to tell the difference between right and wrong and good and evil. If it's bringing things into order, if it's organizing the chaos. Our next headline reads, ball field upgrades are planned at Harlan Rogers. ICCC would contribute to project. The replica of Yankee Stadium in Fort Dodge would become the home of the Iowa Central Community College softball team, under a proposal to be considered by the City Council tonight. Two items related to the Ball Diamond are on the Council's agenda. One is an agreement with Iowa Central. The other is a contract for some of the needed work. The Council meeting will begin at 6 p.m. in the Municipal Building, located at 819 First Avenue South. The local version of the historic home of the New York Yankees is located in Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sports Complex. It is at the northeast end of the complex, along with reproductions of Fenway Park in Boston, Wrigley Field in Chicago, and Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. Collectively, these fields are known as the mini majors. Under the proposed agreement with the college, Iowa Central will pay 50% of the costs of installing artificial turf at Yankee Stadium for a maximum of $400,000. That money would be paid to the city in the 2024 and 2025 fiscal years. In return, Iowa Central would get reduced field rental rates through 2033. In a related matter, the council will consider hiring Doyle Construction of Fort Dodge to do some of the preliminary work on the field at a cost of $115,294. The entire project, including the installation of the artificial turf, is scheduled to be done by July 1, 2024. And turning to today's editorials, there's one submitted by Lori Berglund. The headline reads, "Choose Local to Build a Community's Future." It's customary this time of year for newspapers everywhere to write glowing editorials about the virtue of shopping local. After all, throughout the year, local businesses support the ability of local journalists to deliver local news, and we hope you will support them. Local news is important. We are not perfect, but we live and work in our communities. We care about the future because it's our shared future. We grow as the community grows, and we need each other. I happen to be a natural-born shopper. I grew up shopping extensively in my hometown of Webster City and in my mom's native Fort Dodge. Come with me for a minute down memory lane. Call it a visit with the ghost of Christmas past. Take a ride on the Santa train at the Crossroads Mall before it was enclosed. Shop all afternoon and then have dinner at Woolworth's Harvest House restaurant. The malts and club sandwiches were fabulous, as I recall. Venture downtown Fort Dodge and hitch a ride on the elevator at the Boston store. Chat with the helpful lady who operated the elevator's double doors of glass and brass. Watch as the clerk retrieves change sent over the vacuum tube to the register. My mom could tell you what was on each floor of the Boston store. I just remember that it cost a dime to open a bathroom stall, unless one happened to be small enough to crawl under. The floors were very clean. Come on over to Webster City for a full night of shopping. Browse the shoes at Halverson's and Westerveld's. Check out the bargains at Smart and Thrifty. Whatever you do, don't miss the candy counter at Spurgeon's. And before the evening is done, have a steak dinner and a cocktail at Derman's Cafe. Happy times of Christmas past. Those were indeed for me, and I hope for many of us who call this portion of North Central Iowa home. But what about Christmas present and Christmas future? Well, I think they depend, kind of, upon each other and all of us. Shopping locally this Christmas present can very well help us build a brighter Christmas future for our communities. Prospective new businesses will always review sales tax figures from a given community as an important part of their consideration to bring a new business into a community. If prospective businesses see that local residents prefer to drive an hour to shop or spend their dollars online, our communities become less attractive to those prospects. To build local shopping, support what you have. And I believe we have wonderful choices in our local communities. Grab a friend and take a day and really discover what we have here. I would start a list, but I don't want to leave anyone out. For me, shopping local extends not just to locally owned businesses, but also to the national chains that have chosen to do business in our communities. I'm thankful that they are here and part of our community. And it doesn't stop with just one Saturday in November. All year long, choose to save the shipping, save the gas, and develop an eye for the businesses that are here in our communities. I love shopping. I believe that retail therapy should be covered by any decent health insurance plan. Join me this Christmas season and all year round by shopping local first. We can make wonderful memories of time spent shopping in our own hometowns, memories that we can treasure in Christmas yet to come. And that was again written by Lori Berglund, who is a freelance writer from Hamilton County. Now, turning to today's obituaries, first we remember Jeff Tinker. Funeral services for Jeff will be held Tuesday, November 28th at 6 p.m. at Faust Funeral Home in Eagle Grove, with a visitation from 4 to 6 p.m. Next, we remember William Bryan. William D. Bryan, age 85, of Fort Dodge, passed away Thursday, November 23rd at Mercy One in Des Moines. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 29th at Palmer and Swank Funeral Home in Rockwell City. Burial will follow in Rose Hill Cemetery. A visitation will be at 9 a.m. prior to the service at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. Next, we remember Thomas Ryle. Thomas Bernard Ryle died peacefully on Thanksgiving Day, November 23rd, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, at the age of 87. A mass of a Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Friday, December 1st, at Holy Trinity Church in Fort Dodge. Burial will follow in Corpus Christi Cemetery. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, with a rosary beginning at 6:30 p.m., at Laufersweiler Funeral Home in Fort Dodge. All are welcome to attend and celebrate Tom's life. In lieu of flowers, please send donation to the Alzheimer's Association at alz.org. The family would like to thank Tallamore Senior Living Memory Care and St. Croix Hospice for their loving care. Next, we remember Paul Cahill. Paul Cahill, age 76, formerly of Fort Dodge, passed away on Saturday, November 25th at the Pomeroy Care Center. His wishes were to be cremated, and a private interment will be held at a later date at North Lawn Cemetery. Arrangements have been entrusted with Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Next, we remember Pamela Hack. Pamela A. Hack, age 55, of Fort Dodge, passed away Saturday, November 25th at Fort Dodge Health and Rehabilitation. Services are pending with Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Next, we remember Shirley Waddell. Shirley L. Waddell, age 93, of Fort Dodge, passed away Sunday, November 26th at the Marion Home. Services are pending with Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Next, we remember Judy Fowler. Services for Judy will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 29th at United Methodist Church in Rockwell City. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Palmer Swank Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Next, we remember Bonnie Barnett. Bonnie K. Barnett, age 80, of Fort Dodge, passed away Thursday, November 16th at Iowa Methodist Medical Center. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 29th at Laufersweiler Funeral Home. Burial will follow at North Lawn Cemetery. A visitation will be Wednesday from 10 a.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. Next, we remember Corey Harklow. Funeral services for Corey will be on Wednesday, November 29th at 10:30 a.m. at Zion Lutheran in Humboldt. Visitation will be Tuesday, November 28th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Zion Lutheran in Humboldt. Lent's funeral home is in charge of arrangements. And now turning to some local sports headlines for Fort Dodge. We have this one that reads, Dodgers tip off in hoops. Fort Dodge senior high basketball teams head to Boone for opener. And the dateline is Boone. Fort Dodge's 2023-2024 basketball season begins on Monday as the Dodgers square off with Boone. The varsity girls will tip at 6 p.m. in the Toreador Gym, with the boys to follow at 7:30. The Fort Dodge Senior High boys will then make their home debut on Tuesday against Class 3A powerhouse and defending state runner-up Clear Lake, with both squads starting Iowa Alliance Conference division play on Friday at home versus Ames. Head coach Scott Messerly's Dodger girls return three starters and two key reserves from a year ago, when Fort Dodge went 12-10 overall for its best season in over a decade. Starters L.J. Mall, Mia McCaleb, and Mackenzie McElrath return, with top bench players Ashlyn Wills and Brooklyn Palmer sliding into the lineup. Mail averaged 10 points, 5 rebounds, 3 assists, and 2 steals in garnering second-team All-IAC North honors and becoming the program's all-time leading freshman scorer in the 5-on-5 era last winter. McCaleb, a junior, and McElrath, a senior, were all IAC North honorable mention choices. McCaleb averaged 3.9 points, 3.3 rebounds, 3.3 assists, and 2.4 steals. McElrath was at 6.7, 3.4, 2.3, and 3.2, respectively. The Boone girls are already 3-0, with lopsided wins over Webster City and Des Moines East, before a 50-43 triumph versus Nevada. Senior Aaron Aides is the lone returning starter for the Toreadors. The Ames girls are 1-1, with a victory against Cedar Rapids Jefferson and a loss to number 11 Class 5A Southeast Polk. Juniors Anissa Percival and Carson Pankinen have been the Little Cyclones' top performers to date. On the boys' side, head coach Willie Williams welcomes back starters Cade Westerhoff, Ty Adams, and Drake Warland. Westerhoff, who averaged 7.8 points and 4.1 rebounds, and Warland are juniors. Adams is a senior. Sophomore Tytrell Mosley and junior Jace Nkvinda are also likely to be in the initial Fort Dodge Senior High lineup, with junior Carter Woodruff returning as another important contributor. The Boone boys were 7-15 last year and have junior Wes Van Pelt, sophomore Jude Baumgartner, and junior Tyson Shivers back as top contributors. Clear Lake and Ames were both state qualifiers last season. The Lions went 22-2 and welcomed star junior Thomas Meyer, who averaged 14.6 points and 7.2 rebounds, senior Kale Stefani, and junior Titan Schmidt back to the mix. The defending IAC North champion Little Cyclones have junior Jameson Poe, who averaged 9.8 points and 3.5 rebounds, a former Fort Dodge student, returning for his junior campaign alongside classmate Deshaun Long. And you are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 27th, on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's news for Mason City. And guest columnist Bob Jensen has some fishing thoughts today. He writes, "Where I live, it's too cold to go open water fishing, and not cold enough to make ice for ice fishing. So I think about open water fishing and ice fishing. Following are some of those thoughts. For many of us, there's a social aspect to ice fishing. Spending time with friends is an important part of ice fishing. I think that's where the popularity of those big ice fishing wheelhouses came from. I remember when they were first introduced and what they've evolved to. Ice anglers wondered if those things would ever catch on. They did catch on. Heaters, microwaves, and stoves became part of the ice fishing experience. So did televisions in the wheelhouse that allowed us to watch football games and other televisions hooked up to underwater cameras that showed what might be looking at our lures. Conversations, card games, chili, and brats became important parts of the style of ice fishing. Then I think about the catching a fish idea behind ice fishing. For many of us, catching a fish is one of the main reasons that we go ice fishing, and experience has taught that to increase your fishing success through ice, you need to be moving around, looking for the fish. This is best done from a portable ice shelter. Portable shelters today are warm, roomy, and can be pulled from hole to hole easily. Clam is the pioneer in portable shelters. They have something for any angler who wants to increase their catching by being mobile on the ice. Next, my thoughts go to the outerwear that many of us rely on when we go ice fishing. Again, when they first came out, many of us wondered if those expensive bibs and parkas would catch on. They did. The folks at Ice Armor vigorously tested different materials and construction and designed clothing that makes it possible for us to be comfortable on the ice in some pretty nasty conditions. My recollections then turn to open water fishing, and those thoughts take me back to my early days of fishing on small rivers. These small rivers that I waded were where I learned much of what I know today about river fishing. The most important thing I learned is that fish are very in tune with their environment. In rivers, fish that are hungry often face upstream. They instinctively know that a wounded bug or minnow will be washing downstream with the current. By facing upstream, the fish can see that bug or minnow better. So it usually works best to cast upstream and let your bait work downstream. It also became very apparent that river fish, from minnows to predators, are very aware of their surroundings. When fishing, an angler doesn't want to be silhouetted against the sky above the fish. Every now and then, I'll stand very still on the bank above the fish, exactly where I wouldn't stand if I was trying to catch them. In the clear water, I can see the fish moving about. If I don't move, the fish aren't scared. But as soon as the fish get in my shadow, the tiniest movement from me will spook them quickly out of the area. If you want to catch fish, don't spook them. Most anglers enjoy recalling fishing memories, and as soon as there's safe ice, many of us will be making it. As soon as there's safe ice, many of us will be on it, making more memories. And appearing on the front page of today's Globe Gazette is this headline: More hostages released. Third group includes one American. 39 Palestinians also freed. And the dateline is Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. The fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas was back on track Sunday as the militants freed 17 more hostages, including 14 Israelis and the first American, in a third exchange under a four-day truce that the U.S. said it hoped would be extended. In return, Israel released 39 Palestinian prisoners. Most hostages were handed over directly to Israel, waving to a cheering crowd as they arrived at an Air Force base. Others left through Egypt. Israel's army said one was airlifted to a hospital, and the director of Soroka Medical Center said Alma Avram, age 84, was in a life-threatening condition as a result of an extended period of time when an elderly woman was not taken care of as needed. The youngest hostage released was Abigail Idan, a four-year-old girl and dual Israeli-American citizen, whose parents were killed in the Hamas attack that started the war on October 7th. What she endured was unthinkable, President Joe Biden said of the first American freed under the truce. In all, nine children ages 17 and younger were on the list, according to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office. Three more Thai nationals were released. Separately, Hamas said it released a Russian hostage in response to the efforts of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Russian-Israeli citizen was the first male hostage to be freed. The Palestinian prisoners released were children and young men, ages 15 to 19, largely accused of public disorder, property damage, and in some cases causing or threatening physical harm to Israeli officers by throwing stones and Molotov cocktails. Many were scooped up from protests and confrontations with troops. In turn, many Palestinians view prisoners held by Israel, including those implicated in attacks, as heroes resisting occupation. A fourth exchange was expected on Monday, the last day of the ceasefire, during which a total of 50 hostages and 115 Palestinian prisoners are to be freed. Most are women and children. International mediators, led by the U.S. and Qatar, are trying to extend the ceasefire that began Friday. We can get all the hostages back home. We have to keep pushing, said two of Idan's relatives, a great aunt and cousin, in a statement thanking mediators. Hamas, for the first time, said it would seek to extend the deal by looking to release a larger number of hostages. Netanyahu issued a statement saying he had spoken to Biden and reiterated his offer to extend the ceasefire by an additional day for every 10 hostages Hamas releases. But he said Israel would resume its offensive with all of our might once the truce expires. Ahead of the latest release, Netanyahu in body armor visited the Gaza Strip, where he spoke with troops. At the end of the day, we will return everyone, he said of the hostages, adding that, we are continuing until the end, until victory. Nothing will stop us. It was not clear where he went inside Gaza. This is the first significant pause in 7 weeks of war, marked by the deadliest Israeli-Palestinian violence in decades. More than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed, roughly two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza. The war has claimed more than 1,200 Israelis, mostly civilians, killed in the initial attack. Hamas's military wing released a video showing militants handing over the hostages to Red Cross workers and paramedics, with some of the balaclava-wearing fighters and hostages waving goodbye to each other. Families from the southern Israeli town of Kfar Azah embraced, cried, and applauded Sunday at the news that hostages from their town had arrived in Israel. More than 70 members of the kibbutz of around 700 people were killed, and 18 were kidnapped. The freed hostages have mostly stayed out of the public eye. Hospitals said their physical condition has largely been good, Little is publicly known about the conditions of their captivity. Mirav Raviv, whose three relatives were released on Friday, said they had been fed irregularly and lost weight. One reported eating mainly bread and rice and sleeping on a makeshift bed of chairs pushed together. Hostages sometimes had to wait for hours to use the bathroom, she said. Pressure from families has sharpened the dilemma facing Israel's leaders, who seek to eliminate Hamas as a military and governing power. Hamas and other militant groups seized around 240 people during the incursion into southern Israel that ignited the war. 58 have been released. One was freed by Israeli forces, and two were found dead inside Gaza. The pause has given some respite to Gaza's 2.3 million people, still reeling from relentless Israeli bombardment that has driven three-quarters of the population from their homes and leveled residential areas. Rocket fire from Gaza militants into Israel also went silent. War-weary Palestinians in northern Gaza, where the offensive has focused, returned to the streets. Entire city blocks in around Gaza City have been gutted by airstrikes. But those among the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who fled the north have been turned back by Israeli troops while trying to return to check their homes. They opened fire on anyone approaching from the south, said Rami Harazain, who fled Gaza City. The Israeli military has ordered Palestinians not to return to the north or approach within a half mile of the border fence. The Palestinian Red Crescent Rescue Service said Israeli forces opened fire Sunday on two farmers in central Gaza, killing one and wounding the other. An Israeli military spokesperson said they weren't aware of the episode. The United Nations says the truce has made it possible to scale up the delivery of food, water, and medicine to the largest volume since the start of the war, but it calls the amount of 160 to 200 trucks a day hardly enough. And the other article from today's front page is this headline that reads, Dubai looks to benefit from hosting COP28 climate talks. And the dateline is Dubai, United Arab Emirates. In a city known for its excesses, whether reaching toward the sky with the world's tallest building or hard partying at its beach resorts and bars, Dubai has pulled off another record-breaking feat in the rolling dunes of its desert outskirts. Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum Solar Park, named for the ruling sheikh of Dubai, stretches across some 47 square miles and represents a pledge of $1 billion by this city-state to reach its goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2050. It's a solar-paneled gamble in a city where casinos have yet to arrive, though it always seems to be betting big, no matter the risk. Rising rapidly from a creek-bound pearling village to a city associated with international glamour, Dubai has a long history of finding economic success amid the war-ravaged woes of the wider Middle East. Its ruling family likely views the upcoming United Nations COP28 climate talks as another such opportunity, though it carries the significant peril of becoming synonymous with the collapse in negotiations on limiting greenhouse emissions or being overshadowed by the Israel-Hamas war in the Gaza Strip. There's a risk of reputational damage to the UAE if they fail to make any traction in the talks, particularly as they are a major oil producer, said Christian Coates Ulrichsen, a research fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute, who has long studied the region. There is also a risk that media and civil society coverage will focus critically on issues such as the UAE's planned expansion of oil production capacity and depict the UAE as part of the problem rather than the solution in terms of climate politics. In response to questions from the Associated Press about criticism over its foreign policy and other issues, the Emirati government insisted that the UAE is deeply committed to human rights and building upon its steady progress in this field. As the host of COP28, the UAE will welcome constructive dialogue and continue to work with international partners and stakeholders to deliver impactful results, the statement said. Climate change is a global problem that demands a collective effort, and this significant, momentous event will be a conference of action. Given the futuristic skyline of downtown Dubai and how it gleams at night as one side of the Burj Khalifa lights up with a massive 525-foot LED display, it can be easy to forget that the city only received its first electrical generator in 1952. Before that, only candles and kerosene lamps lit the night along its eponymous Dubai Creek, where the village first grew. In recent years, Dubai has started to focus on renewable energy, despite a momentum where it appeared it would launch a coal-fired power plant before switching it to be fueled by natural gas, as its hosting of COP28 loomed. Overall, the Emirates say it plans to be carbon neutral by 2050. While not specifically outlining its plans to achieve the goal, projects like the solar park and Abu Dhabi's Barak nuclear power plant, the first on the Arabian Peninsula, aim to make generating electricity a green endeavor. And now turning to today's obituaries, first we remember Charles Rayburn. Charles Harvey Rayburn, age 80, of Mason City, died Wednesday, November 22nd, at home. Memorial services for Charles will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 28th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, with Pastor Dan Garriott's officiating. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service, beginning at 10 a.m. at the funeral home. Next, we remember Carl Solem. Carl William Solem, age 95, of Mason City, passed away surrounded by family on Friday, November 17th, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A funeral service for Carl will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, December 9th, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City. The burial ceremony will be held in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City immediately following the service. Visitation will begin 1 hour prior to the funeral service from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the funeral home. And now turning to Dear Abby. Abby responds to three letters today. The first one has a headline that reads, "Boyfriend's bad advice proves costly to woman." They write, "Dear Abby, I went to visit a man I was dating, and there was no visitor parking available. He told me to park in any space, even though there were signs stating non-residents would be towed. He said not to worry about it, that I'd be there only a few hours. Suffice it to say, I got towed. He did drive me to the tow yard to retrieve my car, but he didn't offer to pay for my tow charge, or even half of it. I thought it would have been nice of him to at least offer, and that his not offering demonstrated lack of character. Yes, I know I chose to believe him and at my own risk, and that I'm responsible for my choices, but I trusted his information. In your opinion, did that demonstrate questionable character on his part?" And it's signed Toad in Texas. And Abby replies, "Dear Toad, I'm not sure it demonstrated lack of character, but it certainly demonstrated lack of generosity. If he couldn't bring himself to take full responsibility, I agree he could have offered to pay half the fee. I hope you put this guy in the rearview mirror." And Abby's second letter today has a headline that reads, "Parent shocked by disrespectful language. They write, "Dear Abby, I overheard my adult child speak to his significant other in a way I have heard only one other time. My child was not raised that way. My spouse and our children lived in what I thought was a traditional upbringing. I was shocked the first time and calmly expressed that speaking to another person with those words are disrespectful. I chalked it up to being young and not being mindful of other people's feelings. Once again, although I was not attempting to eavesdrop, I heard the same language. I expressed that I was disappointed, embarrassed, and ashamed of that language directed at another person. I suggested therapy to deal with this, but it scares me to think I don't know my own child, and they are capable of such behavior. Is it possible I raised a Jekyll and Hyde, or a young adult with no sense of pride or manners? And it's signed, Not My Child." And Abby responds, "Dear Not My Child, it is possible that you raised an adult child who has trouble controlling their temper and forgets that vulgarity and disrespect lessen the target's respect for the invective thrower. Therapy might help if your child is open to it, but having suggested it, the time has come for you to step out of this unfortunate scenario. The exception would be if you are afraid the verbal abuse could escalate." And Abby's final letter today has a headline that reads, "Aunt Hurt When Relatives Avoid Her." They write, "Dear Abby, I'm a single, childless aunt and great aunt. For decades, I took on the task of traveling to visit family while the kids were young. No problem. But I've recently learned the now adult kids have been in my area and never contacted me. I was extremely hurt and let them know it when the opportunity presented itself. I am also insulted that they would make no effort. My initial reaction is to no longer make the effort. What to do?" And it's signed, "Aching Auntie." And Abby replies, "Dear Auntie, the first thing to do is ask your nieces and nephews why they didn't let you know they were nearby. Once you know the reason, you can decide how much effort you want to make to see them in the future." And now turning to local sports, we have this headline that reads, "High School Sports, Girls Rugby Taking Off Again at Mason City." Cassie Dre did not need to have her arm twisted. From 2017 to 19, Mason City High School offered a girls' club rugby team. When COVID hit, the team kind of went by the wayside. But a year ago, a team was formed at nearby Central Springs. As the Iowa Youth Rugby Association season progressed towards the 2023 season this fall, the interest of a new Riverhawk girls program built. That is where Dre, a Mason City Intermediate School physical education teacher, comes into the picture. Dre is easily one of the biggest rugby aficionados in North Iowa. From 2004 to 2009, Dre played for highly successful Northern Iowa women's rugby squad. She was so good, Dre was invited to play for, in succession, the Iowa U-23 Select Side, the Midwest U-23 Select Side, and the Team USA U-23 Side, among other select teams. Dre also helped coach the USA sides in tournaments in Wales and Canada. "I helped out last year in Central Springs, and there was a lot of interest to get it back in Mason City," Dre said. 14 girls form the 2023 Riverhawks 7 side this fall, and by all means, it turned out to be a great season. There are two different styles of rugby, the game of 15s, which has been around the longest, and the newest fast-paced game of 7s, where games consist of 2 7-minute halves. The 7s game is also an Olympic sport. A win over Norwalk, 19-17, qualified Mason City for the state tournament, where it lost to Southeast Polk in the first round in Fort Dodge. That the state champions were Cedar Falls. Mason City also scored wins over Cedar Rapids, 38-5 and 22-10, Fort Dodge, 17-15, and West Des Moines Valley, 28-0. The Riverhawks finished their season 5-7 overall, and scrum half Reggie Spots was named first team All-State. A lot of these girls were introduced to the sport less than a month before the season, said Dre, who was assisted by Sherry Hasselmore, a native of New Zealand, who played rugby at Winona State. The girls worked hard and made the season a memorable one. They took a brand new sport and rolled with it, gained confidence and ability as the season went on. We can't thank the girls enough for their openness and willingness to try something new. It was so great to see how much of them grew as the season. Mason City only had three seniors on its roster this fall, which has Dre excited for the future. We are grateful for all the support and excitement to reignite rugby, Dre said. Since we are a club sport and not sanctioned, we had to fundraise to cover all of our expenses. We had local businesses and community members who generously donated to make this season happen. We have girls who are excited for next season and eager to train. The goal is to grow the sport in the area and create opportunities for our youth. And that concludes today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger and the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, November 27th. I'm your reader, Mark John Conley. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening, and make it a great Monday. Thank you.
Exploring Science and the Sea. If zombies ever run out of brains to munch on, they might look to the sea for more. They can find brains that are up to 6 feet tall and live for almost a millennium. The brains might be a little crunchy, though. They're corals, so they consist of a hard skeleton with a thin coating of living organisms. Brain corals are generally round or oblong, with a wrinkled surface that looks like the contours of a human brain. They're found in tropical waters in the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, parts of the Atlantic, and elsewhere. They're made by coral polyps, small organisms that cluster together in colonies. The polyps produce calcium carbonate, a rocky substance that forms a hard skeleton, with the polyps living on the outer surface. The skeleton gets bigger over time as polyps die and new generations make their homes on top of their remains. Unlike the polyps that make up some other corals, those that make brain corals are all connected. They can exchange food, oxygen, and other substances. That makes the colony more efficient, but it also makes it more vulnerable to disease. Brain corals grow slowly. In fact, the oldest may have been around for 900 years. As they grow, they become sturdy anchors for coral reefs. They provide protection for fish and other organisms. And they can absorb the energy of storms. That helps insulate the coast from storm surges and other damaging effects. So protecting coral habitat is a brainy way to protect the coast from hurricanes, if not zombies. Science in the Sea is available as a weekly podcast at scienceinthesea.org. I'm Holly Brawley.